Great areas of the American interior were prairie land, whose nomadic tribes subsisted upon vast herds of the now practically extinct bison. In their manner of life, in their painted garments and their free use of paint, in their general physical characteristics, these prairie Indians showed remarkable resemblances to the later Paleolithic men of the Solutrean Age in Europe. But they had no horses. They seemed to have made no very great advance from that primordial state, which was probably the state in which their ancestors had reached America. They had, however, a knowledge of metals, and most notably a free use of native copper, but no knowledge of iron. As the Spaniards penetrated into the continent, they found and they attacked, plundered and destroyed two separate civilized systems that had developed in America, perhaps quite independently of the civilized systems of the Old World. One of them was the Aztec civilization of Mexico, the other that of Peru. They had probably arisen out of the Heliolithic sub-civilization that had drifted in canoes across the Pacific, island by island, step by step, age after age, from its region of origin round and about the Mediterranean. We've already noted one or two points of interest in these unique developments. Along their own lines, these civilized peoples of America had reached to a state of affairs roughly parallel with the culture of pre-dynastic Egypt or the early Sumerian cities. Before the Aztecs and the Peruvians, there had been still earlier civilized beginnings which had either been destroyed by their successors or which had failed and relapsed of their own accord. The Aztecs seem to have been a conquering, less civilized people, dominating a more civilized community as the Aryans dominated Greece and North India. Their religion was a primitive, complex, and cruel system in which human sacrifices and ceremonial cannibalism played a large part. Their minds were haunted by the idea of sin and the need for bloody propitiations. The Aztec civilization was destroyed by an expedition under Cortés. He had 11 ships, 400 Europeans, 200 Indians, 16 horses, and 14 guns. But in Yucatan, he picked up a stray Spaniard who had been a captive with the Indians for some years and who had more or less learnt various Indian languages and knew that the Aztec rule was deeply resented by many of its subjects. It was in alliance with these that Cortés advanced over the mountains into the Valley of Mexico in 1519. How he entered Mexico, how its monarch Montezuma was killed by his own people for favoring the Spaniards, how Cortés was besieged in Mexico and escaped with the loss of his guns and horses, and how after a terrible retreat to the coast he was able to return and subjugate the whole land, is a romantic and picturesque story which we can't even attempt to tell here. The population of Mexico to this day is largely of native blood, but Spanish has replaced the native languages, and such culture as exists is Catholic and Spanish. The still more curious Peruvian state fell a victim to another adventurer, Pizarro. He sailed from the Isthmus of Panama in 1530 with an expedition of 168 Spaniards. Like Cortés in Mexico, he availed himself of the native dissensions to secure possession of the doomed state. Like Cortés, too, who had made a captive and tool of Montezuma, he seized the Inca of Peru by treachery and attempted to rule in his name. Here again we can't do justice to the tangle of subsequent events, the ill-planned insurrections of the natives, the arrival of Spanish reinforcements from Mexico, and the reduction of the state to a Spanish province. Nor can we tell much more of the swift spread of Spanish adventurers over the rest of America, outside the Portuguese reservation of Brazil. To begin with, each story is nearly always a story of adventurers and of cruelty and loot. The Spaniards ill-treated the natives. They quarreled among themselves. The law and order of Spain were months and years away from them. It was only very slowly that the phase of violence and conquest passed into a phase of government and settlement. But long before there was much order in America, a steady stream of gold and silver began to flow across the Atlantic to the Spanish government and people. After the first violent treasure hunt came plantation and the working of mines. With that arose the earliest labor difficulty in the New World. At first the Indians were enslaved with much brutality and injustice, but to the honor of the Spaniards this didn't go uncriticized. The natives found champions, and very valiant champions, in the Dominican order, and in a secular priest, Las Casas, who was for a time a planter and slave owner in Cuba until his conscience smote him. An importation of Negro slaves from West Africa also began quite early in the 16th century. After some retrogression, Mexico, Brazil, and Spanish South America began to develop into great slave-holding, wealth-producing lands. We can't tell here, as we'd like to do, of the fine civilizing work done in South America, and more especially among the natives, by the Franciscans, and presently by the Jesuits, who came into America in the latter half of the 16th century after 1549. So it was that Spain rose to a temporary power and prominence in the world's affairs. It was a very sudden and very memorable rise. From the 11th century, this infertile and corrugated peninsula had been divided against itself. Its Christian population had sustained a perpetual conflict with the Moors. Then, by what seems like an accident, it achieved unity just in time to reap the first harvest of benefit from the discovery of America. Before that time, Spain had always been a poor country. It's a poor country today. Almost its only wealth lies in its mines. For a century, however, through its monopoly of the gold and silver of America, it dominated the world. The east and center of Europe were still overshadowed by the Turk and Mongol. The discovery of America was itself a consequence of the Turkish conquests, very largely through the Mongolian inventions of compass and paper, and under the stimulus of travel in Asia, and of the growing knowledge of Eastern Asiatic wealth and civilization, came this astonishing blazing up of the mental, physical, and social energies of the Atlantic fringe. For close in the wake of Portugal and Spain came France and England, and presently Holland, each in its turn taking up the role of expansion and empire overseas. The center of interest for European history, which once lay in the Levant, shifts now from the Alps and the Mediterranean Sea to the Atlantic. For some centuries, the Turkish Empire and Central Asia and China are relatively neglected by the limelight of the European historian. Nevertheless, these central regions of the world remain central, and their welfare and participation is necessary to the permanent peace of mankind. 9. And now let's consider the political consequences of this vast release and expansion of European ideas in the 14th and 15th centuries. With the new development of science, the exploration of the world, the great dissemination of knowledge through paper and printing, and the spread of a new craving for freedom and equality. How was it affecting the mentality of the courts and kings that directed the formal affairs of mankind? We've already shown how the hold of the Catholic Church upon the consciences of men was weakening at this time. Only the Spaniards, fresh from a long and finally successful religious war against Islam, had any great enthusiasm left for the Church. The Turkish conquests and the expansion of the known world robbed the Roman Empire of its former prestige of universality. The old mental and moral framework of Europe was breaking up. What was happening to the dukes, princes, and kings of the old dispensation during this age of change?